Global Connections Television is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guests. We invite you to go to the website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous shows. If you're involved with a PBS or community access television station or an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup, or perhaps a podcast or just a computer and would like to share the programs, please feel free to do so. Global Connections is provided at no cost to help people in the U.S. and worldwide better understand how international issues impact our lives.
Welcome to today's Global Connections program. I'm Bill Miller. Today, we're going to be talking about a very interesting organization that is providing wonderful services. It is the Population Institute. My guest today is an expert on the Institute. Kathleen Mogelgaard is president and CEO of the Population Institute, where she directs the organization's advocacy and public education activities. Her career includes roles at Population Action International, Oxfam America, National Audubon Society, the University of Maryland, and the Population Reference Bureau. Kathleen Mogelgaard, welcome to today's Global Connections program.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. I appreciate you being with me. Why don't we just jump right into it? What is the Population Institute? What does it do? What's its mission?
The Population Institute is a research and advocacy organization with a mission to promote universal access to reproductive health care for everyone, everywhere. We believe this is something that will help to improve the health and well-being of people and the planet. And we really work to support policies and programs that promote sexual and reproductive health and rights. We do this through building and synthesizing evidence about demographic trends and barriers to sexual and reproductive health, through educating policymakers and other decision makers about the benefits of eradicating those barriers and the ways in which they can help to expand the rights and opportunities of people, particularly women and girls around the world. And then we work to build and support champions who can lead the way toward universal access to sexual and reproductive health care. And ultimately, we believe, toward a more just and sustainable future.
And that is certainly a noble goal we should all have. If our viewers would like more information, they can go to www.populationinstitute.org to get a lot more information than we'll be able to touch today. We're going to get into some of your services, studies, different items like that. But I'm just curious, you have a lot of partners, no doubt about it. But one of the biggest players in this area is UNFPA, the United Nations Population Fund. How do you interact with UNFPA?
Yeah, thank you for that question. You know, the Population Institute has been around for more than 50 years. We were established in 1969. And at that time, we worked very hard to build support for this new UN body called the United Nations Population Fund. We worked really hard to build US government support to getting UNFPA on the ground and ensuring that countries around the world were providing support to the UNFPA. We believe really strongly that the role of the United Nations Population Fund globally is absolutely critical. They work in more than 150 countries to promote gender equality, to ensure access to reproductive health care and maternal care, infant care, and to really promote the health and well-being of young people. They do remarkable work around the world, but of course, their funding is completely voluntary. Nation states from around the world make contributions to UNFPA, but those are voluntary contributions. So the Population Institute has a long history of advocating for the U.S. government and other governments to give robust contributions to UNFPA to ensure that their work around the world can continue.
We certainly do. And so many of the policymakers in Congress do not understand what the UNFPA does. They have a totally misguided idea. They think it's an abortion clinic, which it's not. It's not even close. But we really need to learn more about it, and we need to fund these organizations because they do such wonderful work. And as you mentioned, they help women and young females especially, but the whole family, not just It's not just the women, the female part of the family. Well, let's jump into some of the challenges. Right now, the globe has about 8.2 billion people on it. The UN predicts another 2.5 billion. What does that portend, I think, by is 2050 or 2100? But what does that portend for planet Earth? How many people can we sustain on this planet?
Well, that's kind of the million-dollar question. How many people can the Earth support? And of course, that has a lot to do with what we want, you know, kind of what we prioritize, what we want to see in terms of people's health and well-being. You know, part of what we work on at the Population Institute is to help folks understand the relationships between population and the issue of climate change, for example. And the way the population grows through this century will have lots of implications for how we're able to contend with the climate change crisis. You know, right now we have around 700 million people around the world who don't have reliable access to electricity. And certainly the way we generate electricity is that is something that can have an exacerbating effect on climate change if we're choosing to produce electricity through the combustion of fossil fuels. So the numbers of, I guess this is a long way of saying the numbers of people that the Earth can support depend a lot on how we choose to invest in things that people are going to need. It also depends on how many people we will have throughout this century. And the work that we do at the Population Institute is really to try to help policymakers and decision makers better understand what demographic trends are and what their implications are. And certainly we're at a point right now where I think there's a lot of confusion about world population issues, about global population trends. If you look at the headlines, you'll see sometimes verging on alarmism about population aging or population decline. You know, when I am out and about talking to policymakers or the general public, it's often fairly common for folks to not appreciate that the world's population is still growing globally. And as you mentioned, the demographers at the United Nations expect that we will probably add another 2 billion or more people to the planet this century. And that's something that I think is becoming a little bit lost in all of the noise, because we are increasingly living in this world that is demographically divided, that we have countries that are experiencing population decline. But at the same time, there are a lot of countries around the world that are still experiencing rapid population growth. And being able to understand both of those trends and their implications is something that we feel is really important, so that we can be making investments today and promoting policies today that really meet people's needs. And as we were saying earlier, help to set us up for a more just and sustainable future.
Most assuredly, that is something we should strive towards. But you've done a lot of groundbreaking work in this area. As I recall back several decades ago now, Paul Ehrlich wrote a book, The Population Bomb. Just briefly, what was the gist of that book and why was it so important?
Yeah, so The Population Bomb was published in 1969, which incidentally was the same year that the Population Institute was established. That was at a time in world history when global population growth rates had reached their peak. And policymakers, academics, folks all over the place were starting to think about what does this rate of population growth mean? There was emerging alarmism around the growth of world population at that time. The world's population had just passed 4 billion people at that time. And Dr. Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb, went on a big speaking tour across the United States, all over the world, was on the Johnny Carson show, really helping to raise people's awareness around rapid population growth and the implications that it could have. It did create a sense of alarmism about rapid population growth and what it means, and in some cases led to policies and practices that were coercive in nature, that didn't extend people's rights, but actually, in some cases, trampled on people's rights around their reproductive choices. So we're in an era today, we've kind of left the 1969 and early 1970s population alarmism behind, But we're also still think it's really critically important to understand population trends and their implications, particularly in places where it can shine a light on the unmet needs that people have, or the opportunities that they have limitations on, or the ways in which people do not continue not to have agency and reproductive autonomy. So a lot of the places where we work with partners around the world, those are places that continue to experience rapid population growth that is often linked to a lack of gender equity, to a lack of meaningful access to reproductive health care and family planning services that would enable people to avoid unintended pregnancy and to really achieve their reproductive goals. So we're continuing to try to shine a light on that. We have not finished the job for women and girls in terms of expanding their rights and opportunities, especially their rights around reproductive health care. And it can be really tricky in this time when we hear these messages around population decline and population aging to remember that we still have a really important job to do in expanding rights and opportunities for women and girls around the world.
It's absolutely essential that we maintain the rights, as well as all of our responsibilities too, as we move forward on these programs. And we're going to be talking about those in just a minute. Well, you're watching Global Connections Television, which is a privately funded, independently produced program. The opinions expressed on Global Connections are solely those of the moderator and his guest. We'd invite our viewers to go to our website at www.globalconnectionstelevision.com to view previous programs. Also, if you're involved with a PBS or community access television station, or if you're with an educational institution that has an intra-campus television hookup, you have a podcast, or you just have a computer, you like our shows and you would like to share them, please feel free to do so. Global Connections Television is provided at no cost as a public service to help us better understand international issues and how they impact our lives. Today, we're taking a look at a very important institution. It's called the Population Institute. My guest today is Kathleen Mogelgaard, who is the president and CEO of the Population Institute. Kathleen, we're talking about, you mentioned a minute ago, I think you said 4 billion people on the planet, back in the 50s or something, now we're at over 8. We're going up. There's no doubt about that. What areas of the world, we can't go through every country, but what are some of the trends in the areas that are increasing population as opposed to countries that are losing, or we're having a gentrification, I guess, of the population? People are getting older, or they're not, let's say the replacement rate is not as high, you know, that type of thing. So what are some of the implications of those two trends?
Yeah. So understanding both population aging and population decline, as well as persistently youthful populations and rapid population growth, both of those are scenarios that carry a lot of implications for how we think about human health and well-being in those different scenarios. So places that are experiencing population aging and population decline, we've heard a lot about protests in France, for example, and trying to think about with a rapidly aging population there, there have been moves to extend the retirement age in an effort to really ensure that Social Security is enough for people in their retirement. Those conversations, even though we're continuing, our population in the United States is continuing to grow, there is a lot of conversation around that, kind of the viability of our Social Security system. For the period of time when the proportion of our national population that is above 65 will be a bigger part of our population than it is today. So thinking about population aging and where we're headed over the next couple of decades is really important for thinking about how we put together the proper social systems and the investment systems for elder care or other kinds of ways in which to support just a population that is getting older. But those things can't happen overnight. So it's important for us to put the plans in place today to the extent that we can. At the same time, for countries that are continuing to experience rapid population growth and have extensive persistently youthful populations, this is a lot of countries that are in sub-Saharan Africa, parts of South Asia, parts of Latin America. That rapid growth presents a lot of challenges as well. in terms of just the ability to provide basic services like education and healthcare to a population that continues to, every generation continues to be bigger. A lot of these countries are already experiencing challenges around food insecurity, for example, or with the impacts of climate change, they're increasing stresses on water supplies and agricultural output. So as those countries are continuing to experience larger and larger generations every year, those systems will continue to be strained. And as I was saying earlier, very often that rapid growth is linked to persistent gender inequality, to issues like child marriage. We work with partners in Niger, for example, where about three quarters of girls are married before the age of 18, and about one third of girls are married before the age of 15. These are things that are really, when it comes to issues of gender equity and investing in our youth and ensuring that youth have opportunities, when girls are getting married at 14, 15 years old, it's really hard for them to have much in the way of opportunities in their lives. They start childbearing very early in life and then continue to have children in many cases over their reproductive lifespan. So the average number of children per woman in Niger is close to seven. And that's something that is continuing to drive rapid population growth there in ways that makes it really difficult for the government to provide even basic services. So understanding those trends is really important for thinking about the investments we can be making today that would address some of those inequalities and the lack of opportunities that women and girls have in a place like Niger or other places that are experiencing this persistent rapid population growth.
You mentioned several systems that are affected. One, the social security system, the retirement system, the educational system, the healthcare system, on across the board. Those all tie in too, and it comes up in every conversation, it seems like, climate change. We cannot get away from the fact that we have a climate crisis. It's not, as Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, it's no longer just climate change. This is, the planet is boiling. Yeah. How do you view climate change and bring that into this whole discussion on the population increase or decrease?
I think it's a really important illustration of the ways in which understanding population trends is absolutely critical for thinking about how we invest and plan in the context of a global crisis. So addressing the climate crisis requires a number of different strategies. One, of course, is reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to the problem in the first place. And the relationship between population growth and emissions growth is a very complicated one, because I think we all appreciate the fact that emissions per capita around the world is very different depending on where you are in the world. Here in the United States, we have some of the highest emissions per capita. We are not a country that is growing rapidly, and yet we are disproportionately contributing to the root causes of the climate change problem. Other parts of the world that are growing rapidly have very small per capita emissions rates. So the population and emissions equation is one that is complicated. And certainly over time, if we're thinking about addressing issues of energy poverty or ensuring that the nearly 700 million people around the world who don't have regular energy access can attain that access, like thinking about how the population will grow and how our emissions will grow over time, it is important to understand that. But one area where I think it's absolutely critical to think about demographic trends and the climate crisis is in the area of climate change vulnerability. So now countries around the world are setting 20, 30, 50-year plans for adapting to the impacts of climate change. We see already how much the impacts of climate change are affecting communities around the world, whether it's flood, droughts, extreme weather, extreme heat. All of these things need to be addressed and planned for. As much as we're doing to reduce emissions, we know we're going to have to continue to grapple with the impacts of climate change. And the ways in which population grows really affects how people and communities and nations are vulnerable to those impacts. So as countries around the world are putting together their long-term adaptation plans to climate change, it's really critical that they think about how their population will be changing. But unfortunately, sometimes the population community or the reproductive health community is not very well integrated with the folks who are doing the long-term climate change adaptation plans. But what we would like to see is greater integration of this so that folks who are thinking about meeting folks' needs for reproductive health care and family planning or promoting gender equity are involved in conversations around how communities will adapt to climate change. That will be helpful for communities in the short term, because when we have greater agency in our lives, when we have greater opportunities to delay childbearing, to pursue education or economic opportunities, that will make us more resilient to the impacts of climate change. But then over the long term too, it will put the brakes on rapid population growth that is taking place in many of the countries that are most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change. And that will be something that will enable greater resilience and adaptive capacity, and ultimately fewer people who are really vulnerable to the impacts of climate change.
And that's something we need to, well, I'm sure the planners, many of them, are looking at how we can do things differently. How can we can cope with the problems that are confronting us right now? But there's another, there's another program, if you want to call it a program. It's the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. They were developed, I believe, in 2015. And there are 17 logical, practical, achievable goals to eliminate poverty, to eliminate hunger, to empower women and girls, to combat climate change as best we can. But how do you factor in the sustainable development goals that are, we were doing well until COVID in some areas, and now we've been set back quite a bit. But the sustainable development goals are very important to me anyway, and to a lot of people. In fact, most people on the planet, we've got 8.2 billion people, but a large number are working towards achieving the climate sustainable development goals. But how do you factor them into your planning and when you talk about population growth?
Yeah. Well, at the Population Institute, we really believe that fundamentally, sexual and reproductive health care is at the root of so many of the sustainable development goals that we aim to achieve. It is a foundational aspect of people's lives to be able to have that kind of agency and autonomy around their reproductive lives. I think any of us who have families understand that the number, timing, and spacing of pregnancies and childbirth is something that intimately affects our lives. And so being able to have agency in one's life to determine whether to become a parent or how often to have kids is something that is really tightly linked to things like education or our ability to access healthcare. It is linked to poverty alleviation. It is linked to food security on an individual level, as well as on a more national or even global level when we're thinking about food supply and the demand for food. All of these things are intimately connected to people's reproductive autonomy, to their access to sexual and reproductive health care, and to the ways in which global population trends intersect with so many of the issues that are part of the Sustainable Development Goals. I agree with you that the SDGs are a really important organizing framework for a lot of the ways that investment around development occurs around the world. Part of what we try to do at the Population Institute, since we are based here in the United States, in Washington, D.C., in the nation's capital, we really try to elevate the sustainable development goals with U.S. policymakers, because we feel sometimes that there is not enough attention to the really important and urgent goals embedded within the sustainable development goals. It's often not seen as a high priority for U.S. policymakers. So we are part of what we do in our organization is to try to raise awareness of the sustainable development goals and the ways in which sexual and reproductive health and rights are an important part of that, but really to try to help policymakers and decision makers here in the United States strengthen their commitment to the sustainable development goals and all that they represent.
Well, just as you alluded before, there's an interdependence of countries, and there's an interrelationship of all of these goals of poverty, human rights, climate change, just on across the board. And we just need to become much more aware of them and to become more involved in helping to come up with some positive solutions that work and we can move forward on all fronts. And we were talking about sustainable development goals, and our viewers, if they would like, they could go to www.un.org to get more information on the sustainable development goals and other activities of the United Nations. But Kathleen Mogelgaard, I want to thank you so very much for a very interesting and a very informative program.
Thank you, Bill. It was a pleasure talking with you today. And thank you for your efforts to bring these conversations to communities around the world. Thank you for what you're doing.
My pleasure. I'm Bill Miller. Thank you for joining us today on Global Connections Television.